Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1977 Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in it. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we are continuing our journey through the W section of the Monster Manual. We're going to talk about the White, the Will-O-The-Wisp, the Windwalker, and the Wolf. Alright, let's get cracking. We'll start with the White. Now, white has become a generic term for a particular type of undead, and whites kind of are in an ambiguous position, I think. They're physical undead, a bit like skeletons or zombies. They're not ghostly undead like wraiths. They're sort of if liches spent less time studying magic and scheming to control the world, and more time just roughing people up and living in dank grave mounds. The term white, of course, comes from The Lord of the Rings, or I should say from the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, because in fact, barrow whites as a concept appear in other of Tolkien's writings in addition to The Lord of the Rings. So whites is an English word that just means people, beings, whatever, right? So they're barrow whites. They're the people or beings that live in the barrows. And I always assumed that the D&D monster white was called this because, you know, Gary Gygax had read the reference to the barrow whites, but had not known what the word white meant, and therefore assumed that it was a word for that kind of monster. But lo and behold, here in the Monster Manual, that vocabulary issue is actually addressed. It says that the word has kind of mutated. It used to just mean, you know, people, any kind of people, and now it refers specifically to these monsters that live in barrow mounds. So the legend of things living in barrow mounds, that the grave is basically like a house and that the dead person still lives in there, is something that turns up a lot in Old Norse literature. You get it in the sagas. There are creatures that kind of permanently live in barrow mounds. So there's an example of one in Grettir's saga that Grettir has a fight with. And there are people who normally are sort of, you know, asleep, lying dead in their mound, but who periodically appear, like Gunnar in Njal's saga. And there's an example of it in Old Norse poetry as well. I'm thinking of The Waking of Angantyr, where Angantyr is this warrior who's lying in a grave mound, and his daughter comes to get the sword from him. You know, the idea that he's buried with his sword, but she needs to take it. Whites are a real classic D&D monster. They date back to the very first version of the game, and what's notable about them particularly is level drain, I guess. You know, initially, they're not described in any great detail, but we do know that they have level drain, and then they get this bigger write-up in the Monster Manual. As I've mentioned before, I'm of two minds about level draining monsters. I do sometimes get the impression that early Dungeons & Dragons was being written and run by people who have a lot more free time than I do, and I say that as a person who puts out a podcast about D&D monsters twice a week. Or a lot more free time in which they could get all their players into the same room. How's that for a compromise? I do feel that modern versions of the game, to some degree, have put so much stuff into the level progression that being knocked back a couple levels feels a bit more like going back and doing the same things over again, which might not be so much the case in earlier versions of the game. I genuinely don't know. Anyway, whites are okay. I do feel that they have never quite acquired the visual identity that some other forms of undead have, right? We all have a mental image of what a lich looks like, we all have a mental image of a wraith and a skeleton and a zombie. And then the white kind of, it's sort of, they're kind of fleshy, but maybe they're bony and they're armored or not, and it's not obvious. So I think today there's a tendency to present whites as looking a bit like the White Walkers from Game of Thrones, who I suppose do look a little bit corpse-like. Next up, we got the Will-O-The-Wisp. Now, obviously, the Will-O-The-Wisp is a real phenomenon, or at least it's a real folkloric phenomenon. This idea of a light that lures people away from the path. And traditionally, this is explained as pockets of luminous marsh gas that can basically create, you know, little glowing lights that might lure unwary travelers into dangerous swamps, which, you know, they wouldn't realize were there because presumably they're not from around here if they're unwary travelers. I am skeptical of the extent to which this phenomenon, like, occurs enough to be behind every instance of the Will-O-The-Wisp story. And in particular, I think that the idea of a misleading light that lures people away from the safe path that they're supposed to walk on is sufficiently, like, obviously connected to the symbolism of early modern European and American belief that I don't think it really needs a scientific explanation per se. What's interesting about the Will-O-The-Wisp in Dungeons & Dragons is that it's one of those creatures that sort of secondarily interested in killing you. It does have an attack. It has a little zappy lightning attack. But what it's mainly interested in is guiding you into dangerous locations where you will die just from the fact that the place is dangerous, that it's full of traps and pits and monsters and whatever. And then it will feed on your life energy, but somebody else is going to go to the effort of killing you. What this means is that the Will-O-The-Wisp in some ways ties into the D&D dichotomy that places that adventurers don't want to go are probably places that the players do want them to. That is to say, the excitement of the game is the characters in bad trouble that a sensible person would avoid. So from a player's perspective, you might as well follow a Will-O-The-Wisp because it's leading you to where there is danger and monsters, i.e. interesting things that you want to interact with. Particularly true because, you know, not following the Will-O-The-Wisp is a very uninteresting interaction. Oh, there are some lights off the path. Well, that's a Will-O-The-Wisp. I better not do that. I think you'd be less annoyed to be lured off the path by a Will-O-The-Wisp than you would be annoyed to miss something important because you mistakenly assumed that a light was a Will-O-The-Wisp. So Will-O-The-Wisps, they're okay. I think after a few times you probably run out of steam with them, right? You want to make sure that there is an occasional Will-O-The-Wisp luring people away in a world where the majority of the lights that they see off of the path are, you know, lights. After the Will-O-The-Wisp, we have the Windwalker. Now, in the last episode, I talked about the Water Weird, and the Water Weird is basically sort of a very specific type of water elemental, in the same way that a salamander is a very specific type of fire elemental, and the Windwalker is basically the same, but it's an air elemental. I think Windwalkers in this monster manual never really quite catch on, because they don't have a distinctive narrative or visual identity. They're basically just kind of air elementals. It's not completely true, but they're basically sort of like servants for other more powerful creatures that pose a challenge tactically, basically because they're completely made of air. One of the ways that you can kill them is by just casting a control weather spell on them and, I don't know, dispersing them. So it's a fun attempt to think through the concept of what would it mean to fight a creature that was, you know, just a sort of sentient breeze. But I don't think they're really one of the hits of the invented for D&D monster genre. In second edition, they do get an illustration, and they look like a bunch of snakes in a sort of whirlwind, which feels like a big mistake to me, because if there's one thing that we can say with certainty about snakes, it is that they do not walk. That's like a wind slitherer. Anyway, I think there are interesting things you could do with the Windwalker, but it would need to take the mechanic of the thing, which is fine, and give it more character than it has in this book, which is to say it's exactly not the right kind of inspiration for me, because there's no reason that you can't do that with a monster that already has a more detailed, fleshed-out version. Speaking of monsters that come with a lot of meaning attached to them, next we have the wolf. And you got three varieties. The wolf, you got your regular old commoner garden wolf, you got your wolf, dire, also known as a warg, and you got your winter wolf. So, the wolf requires no introduction and no explanation. It is a wolf. It's the symbol of predatory malice in most of European folklore. It's simultaneously noble and frightening. You know, we admire wolves. Certainly modern culture does. Medieval culture was quite frightened of them, but almost in a way that is not 100% related to actual experience of wolves. There's a fascinating book on this called Wolves and the Wilderness in the Middle Ages by Alex Pleskovsky, which I have a copy of around here somewhere, and I did read, but a long time ago, so my memory of it is a little bit unclear. But he talks about how wolf folklore actually changes a bit as Europeans' experience of interaction with wolves changes. It's interesting stuff. Then you got your giant wolf. Now, warg is a term that has come to mean a giant wolf, but I'm pretty sure originally just meant wolf, because it's an Old Norse word. Varg just means wolf. So I think it comes from the idea that there's a particularly vicious sort of riding wolf that appears in, again, I think that's, is that in The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings books? Anyway, it's in Tolkien. But I always assumed the goblins were just riding around on regular old wolves. Again, could this be because the word was unfamiliar to readers, so they just imagined that it was something else? Obviously, in the Lord of the Rings films, wargs are a kind of big, hairy monster that is not a wolf, which I understand the idea there. I was very upset when the Mumakil and the Lord of the Rings films weren't just elephants, but at the same time, I guess the idea was to have something that was as imposing and shocking to a modern viewer as an elephant would have been to Sam, whereas we're not going to be impressed by an elephant. That at least would be the theory of somebody who never saw Oliver Stone's Alexander, where the imposing appearance of the elephant is really one of the only good things about it. And then finally, you got the Winter Wolf. Now, sometimes I think that the Winter Wolf is a little bit like gilding the lily. Like, it's basically a big winter-themed wolf that also kind of breathes frost. You can see them the kind of things, you know, frost giants would keep them as pets, and they howl in the bleak cold of the mountains as your party are pitifully sharing out the last remnants of their food, etc., etc., etc. I mean, basically, if you want to have the action and drama and threat of wolves, but your characters are so high level that they don't give a heck about a pack of wolves, I guess that's why winter wolves exist. I don't know. I think there's things you could do with, you know, a single wolf of unusual size and cunning who commands all the other ones that wouldn't necessarily require the proliferation that you get with the winter wolf. But on the other hand, I think there are circumstances where a winter wolf would be pretty cool. I think a winter wolf, or even the winter wolf, is a much better monster than a pack of winter wolves, but that is a very specific preference that I typically have. Anyway, we got a couple of real winners in this episode. I mean, I know I gave them a kind of short shrift, but actually I think whites are pretty good. I like undead in general. I think they just tap into a bunch of fears that we all have. Will-O-Wisp is okay. I can definitely see using it a few times. The Windwalker needs a little more elaboration, but it's got potential. And wolves are just an adventure fiction classic. Now, in our next episode, we're going to round out the W section. We're going to talk about the Wolverine, continuing the trend of me talking about mustelids, the Wraith, which I'm a big fan of, and the Wyvern. So please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.